Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Journal of Southern Religion podcast, an opportunity for our readers to get to listen to the people who think and write about religion in the American South. I'm your host, Mike Pasquet, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Louisiana State University and co-editor of the Journal of Southern Religion. Today I'm sitting in Indianapolis with Jeff Wilson, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies and East Asian Studies at Renison University College, University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. Jeff is a PhD from UNC, and he's the author of Mourning the Unborn Dead, A Buddhist Ritual Comes to America, published in 2009 by Oxford University Press, and hot off the presses, Dixie Dharma, Inside a Buddhist Temple in the American South, came out just this year with the University of North Carolina Press. And it's with his latest book, Dixie Dharma, that we're here to talk about today. So, Jeff Wilson, welcome to the Journal of Religion podcast.
Thank you very much. It is great to have this opportunity.
Thanks for being here. Let's start with just the basic question, and then we'll see how things go from there. What brought you to the study of Buddhism in America, and more specifically, Buddhism in the American South?
Very good place to start. I did some Buddhist studies while I was an undergraduate, and one of the things that I was looking at was the classic question in that discipline about how did Buddhism go from being an Indian religion to a Chinese religion. India and China may both seem like they're in Asia to us, they must be similar, but especially back in the day, completely separate cultural areas. So how did it go from a thoroughly Indian religion to being the most Chinese of all religions? A very interesting situation. Thing is, you know, this happened a long time ago. We were not very good about getting anthropologists on the ground at the time to write this down for us. So we're working with, you know, little bits of inscriptions and very fragmentary evidence. But I was very intrigued by that process of adaptation. I graduate, I move to New York City, and I start noticing all these Buddhists around me. And I start to clue in, wait a minute, I'm living through the same process. It's moving from being, say, a Chinese or Burmese or Japanese religion to becoming an American religion. And I am on the ground. I can start documenting this stuff, and maybe I'll figure it out, maybe I won't, but 500 years from now, somebody can dig up, you know, the stuff that I left for them, the clues, and they might get a much better picture than we have for what happened in pre-modern periods. So that moved me into the study of Buddhism in the United States, or nowadays North America more generally. Right. It was really just the return of classic questions from that discipline applied to new situations where I could use multiple tools, not just epigraphy and textual work, but I could do actual field work amongst the people themselves and try to get at that process of adaptation.
And then so that led you to what we call the South.
Yeah, that led me to Buddhism in America more broadly. Because I have a Southern family connection and I came to do my graduate studies at the University of North Carolina, and I did my field work at a temple in Virginia. And then because I lived in multiple parts of the United States as well as outside of the U.S., I started saying, now, wait a minute, I've been in L.A. Buddhism just isn't the same there as it is in Houston, and certainly not the same as it is in Richmond, Virginia. We need to start talking not just about American Buddhism, but about the places within America that produce different sorts of Buddhist experiences.
Right. So you argue, and this is crucial to your argument, that region is essential to our understanding of American Buddhism. And, you know, this seems an obvious statement, yet in reading your book, it appears that scholars really haven't taken this idea seriously. Why is that, and what's your corrective?
Yeah, that's right. This is really something that hasn't been discussed previously, and I would argue there's a number of reasons. One, people who do study Buddhism in America, it's not a large number of people, but most of them are trained in Buddhist studies or East Asian studies. So, but then they live in the U.S. and they start thinking, oh, look at all these Buddhists around here. It's kind of interesting. But they don't have the American religious history or Southern history background to just apply those analytical frameworks. They don't know about that historiography and everything. So it doesn't really occur to them as much. On the other hand, among the people who do have that good, deep, rich American religious history training, Buddhism isn't really an object of study for those people typically. So there just weren't people who happened to be straddling both worlds. I fortuitously happened to have a foot in each one of those worlds, and so I was able to bring that sort of perspective to the table.
So another important theme, and it's something that a lot of historians of religion in the South think about, and it's this idea of diversity or pluralism.
Right.
I understand that you worked with the Pluralism Project at Harvard. for a while and researching and producing this book. How do you define pluralism, and why do you think it's important to consider pluralism in relation to regionalism and then within the South?
Sure. Yeah, I did have an association with the Pluralism Project. That's quite early on, during my MA fieldwork, actually. So that was before I began working on the sort of regional aspect of this particular project. But obviously, that does influence my thinking about being on at that particular fieldwork site. In terms of pluralism, I tend to follow on from William Hutchison and his approach to pluralism. He has this book, you know, Religious Pluralism in the United States. Right. What's the subtitle? Contentious History of a Founding Ideal, something like that. Yeah. So he lays out kind of a couple of ways of understanding pluralism. First of all, there's the bare fact of pluralism, in other words, diversity. And he wants to argue that there's been diversity in the U.S. from the beginning, but of course it has greatly expanded more recently. But then the second way of looking at pluralism is that pluralism is an attitude towards diversity. So it's an ideal or an orientation or an attitude. And I'm looking at both of those in how I'm approaching Buddhism in the South. So there's the simple diversity question. What are the Buddhists in the South? Where are they? You know, what are they doing? How many of them are there? What types are there? This sort of thing. And then there's the second question of does something about the Southern experience make them more pluralistic, more focused on appreciating diversity, this sort of thing? I do argue in the book that I think there's some reasons to think that is so. So I'm sort of working with both sides of that question of diversity there.
Right. Okay. So then, so let's focus on the diversity part. Can you describe just sort of the lay of the land, the Buddhist landscape in the South? Where are Buddhists in the South and why?
Right. Okay. So you won't be shocked to learn that Buddhism is not about to take over the entire South. You know, not quite yet. Despite some of the harangues you hear occasionally from evangelical pulpits and such. So Buddhists are still numerically underrepresented in the South compared to both its geographic size and to, of course, its population size. In fact, there are about 50% fewer, you know, in terms of the ratio, Buddhists in the Southern population compared to the rest of the United States. So that's one thing to say about the South. It's a less Buddhist area than other parts of the United States, and there are effects that come from that. At the same time, there are a lot more of them than there ever used to be. After all, from 0 to 1, it's greatly increased, right?
Right.
And there's a lot more than one these days. But they're not uniformly distributed, which I think is part of your question there,
right.
Which is one reason why it's important not to just talk even about Buddhism in the South. South is very diverse. There's very different regions within it. And again, this is something I do try to address in the book. Generally speaking, I break the South actually into two different sub-regions. From the perspective of Buddhism. So I talk about it, what I call coastal South, which is to say sort of from the Atlantic and Gulf Coast and, say, 100 miles inland. You know, for
sure.
All, like, this includes many of the largest metropolitan areas. I had to fudge it a bit when I get to Atlantic. You know, that's not on the coast.
Rant, but, yeah.
But hey, you know what? It's still not Kentucky, you know?
Certainly not.
So there's those areas have typically, they are more likely to have larger urban, suburban populations. They have more diverse, ethnically and religiously diverse urban, suburban populations, so that you're more likely to find the Buddhists in those areas. Then you have this kind of inner South, which is kind of the other side of the mountains. And there you find many fewer Buddhists. Okay, they're already at a small percentage. Now they're really dropping again. But what you find there is different types of Buddhist institutions. So you find kind of local temples and study groups in some of those cities and suburbs along that quote-unquote coastal area. What you find is more retreat centers in that more rural inner South, right? Because then the Buddhists build their larger, actually physically larger places there where the property values are lower, they have more space to spread out. They can be in the woods or other places where they don't feel actually as much surveillance from what they sometimes perceive to be a hostile surrounding environment. And so they'll go out there and build big, you know, retreat centers and temples and monasteries tucked away in the mountains or in the woods and this sort of thing. So you get different sort of phenomena even in these different sort of sub-regions.
Right. So you've and you describe that sort of landscape in a survey fashion in the book, but you decide you're going to concentrate on one place, one site.
That's right.
What is that site and why that site?
Okay, so I do draw on experiences, you know, sort of field visits to many Buddhist groups and temples in many southern states, as well as beyond the south, to have something to compare it to. But I'm especially focused on Buddhism in eastern Virginia, especially on Richmond, Virginia. And then my primary fieldwork site is this Ekoji Buddhist Sangha, is the name of the temple there, which is within the city limits of Richmond itself. It's on the western end of the city. But that Ekoji Buddhist temple, very interesting temple, that's where I did the bulk of my fieldwork, and that's where I kind of go back to time and again to provide examples in the book.
So what makes Ekoji the right site to not, you know, definitively, you know, describe what Buddhism is in the South, but it's as a kind of entree to understanding Buddhism? What is it about this particular temple that you found to be so rewarding when it comes to trying to understand religion, pluralism, regionalism?
Sure. Well, one thing about it is it's this unusual situation where you have five different Buddhist groups from different lineages. Think of them as different denominations, basically, of Buddhism, that all co-own and co-use this single site. So in a way, it's like I did five different groups, but they're all together there. So this gave me the opportunity to look at what Zen Buddhists in the South are doing, and Pure Land Buddhists in the South, and Tibetan Buddhists in the South, and so on. So just the fact that I could look at a bunch of things all at once, you know, it's kind of like I could get more bang for my buck at this right. fieldwork site. So that was part of it. Part of it was proximity, because I have family in Virginia that I could stay with, you
Practical
know, and drive
reasons
in.
Are helpful, yeah.
Yep, and I was in Chapel Hill, of course, only about 2.5 hours away. And some of it was that I found the people there to be willing to let me do the project. You know, they gave of themselves. They gave of their time. They were willing. I mean, the fieldwork for this was carried out over about 8, 9, 10 years. Right. And they didn't tire of me too much,
right.
even after all of that.
So, good days and bad days.
Yeah, the fact that this was a site that would allow me to come on and keep bothering them after all that time. Yeah. And then again, the fact that all this, and there were some particular things. They had this contentious relationship with the city, for example. They were involved in local prison ministry. They did the slave trade meditation thing. So there were some things that really surfaced right. Southern issues. And even the fact that you have the five groups there on one site, I argue, comes partially out of the fact that it's in the South. They're forced together because none of them could make it on their own, whereas those groups might easily attract more members, be much more robust individually, say, on the West Coast. In Richmond, they either hang together or they all die together.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so I guess that's, you started to answer my next question mm-hmm. then. So what is distinctively Southern about this particular community? You've already started to explain that. Is there anything else to say about that?
Sure. Well, I would say there's kind of various levels we can do it on. First is just the bare fact, it's in the South.
Right.
So there you go. Number two, because it's in the South, the people who attend it are Southerners. Some of them are native Southerners, others are naturalized Southerners.
There you go.
You know, but they are all living in the South. Many of them are of the South. And so their cultural influences appear in the Buddhism there. But then I like to argue that because they're in the South, and also they're in Richmond, which is not a megalopolis, this is not Atlanta, this
right.
is not Houston, okay? So they have a much smaller Asian American population to draw on. They have a smaller overall population to draw on. This is, you know, Richmond is, you know, it can be a cliche, but it was the capital of the Confederacy. And there is a lot of memory still invested in that, even though it's actually a majority African-American city these days,
right.
bare majority. There's still, there's very, you know, you have the Confederate, you know, Heritage Month marches and everything there. So there's a conservatism. I mean, of course, the Southern Baptists have their missions based there and this sort of thing. So there's a lot that mitigates against them being able to just be out and proud about being Buddhist, you
right.
know, and gathering a big Buddhist population or something. It's not going to happen in Richmond, Virginia, for specific regional purposes. So hey, that's great for me. That makes a good test case for looking for trends that might also apply in other cities and regions within the South as well.
Right. I guess, can you talk a little bit about the ethnic or racial composition of the members of Ekoji? Please.
Sure. Okay. So we've got five different groups. So that complicates this.
Right, doesn't it?
Because you have to talk about each one individually. Luckily, perhaps, most of those groups are overwhelmingly attended by white people. So one of the groups, the Pearland group, is significantly integrated, though. In fact, it's a majority Chinese Americans, mm-hmm. with some Caucasian Americans who attend as well. The other groups tend to be dominated by white folks with your kind of token, okay, there is one Asian American or one African American who attends sometimes, or, you know, they're much more monochromatic, the other groups. So this is mostly a white religious organization. So many of these are newer Buddhists, therefore, with the exception of that Pearland group. And the Pearland group, I do have to say, was the founding group of the temple. Right. And they allowed these other Buddhists to come and join with them and create their own little groups within the temple. So in a way, it does spring from a more pluralistic origins and retains it there. But now other people have been gathered in who do somewhat change the overall demographics.
Right. Okay. So if it's a mostly white, except for the Pure Land.
Yep.
And men and women, more or less, you know.
I should have said something about that, yeah. Absolutely. Okay, so it is pretty balanced, male and female. I mentioned in the book that there's kind of an intellectual Buddhism that you find there. This is not like a strongly devotional, you know, this type, nor is it a sort of evangelical type. It's an intellectual, kind of inward-facing, individualistic sort of Buddhism, which has been practiced. Many of these people are involved in the university culture. Not a big surprise there. Of course, at Richmond, a university city with, you know, VCU, University of Richmond, this sort of stuff. So many of these people are actual professors or students or are former students who first were exposed to Buddhism in their university courses. Another big segment of people are from helping professions that are there. Blue-collar work not strongly represented in this religious organization. That's not to say, however, that's entirely absent, because it's not. Pretty intellectual class, I would say, to this religious organization.
You have a very interesting chapter among all of the interesting chapters, but the I believe it's the final chapter, which is about a very interesting ritual ceremony that was performed a few years back. Can you describe, and what it's basically doing, it's allowing us to think about how race is a part of this story. So can you describe that ritual and then maybe even read a bit from your book?
Sure. So, pardon me. So this was a slave trade meditation vigil. I'm not aware that any of these had been held previously anywhere in the U.S. And so, again, this is to me a very Southern sort of Buddhist ritual, because, you know, there are meditation vigils to bear witness to other social problems in other parts of the country, but they haven't been slavery oriented or the history of slavery.
Right.
They've been things like death penalty at San Quentin in California and homelessness on the streets of New York. Well, when they go to do a meditation vigil, so this kind of what they call engaged Buddhist activity, when they go to do it in Richmond, a southern site, what do they come up with? There are homeless people there. It could have been that kind of street retreat. There are prisons nearby. There's death penalty in Virginia. They could have done that sort of thing. What they go to is that legacy of slavery. So again, the region and its history has produced this particular type of ritual activity. Now, in terms of what they actually did, it's an interesting situation. So Richmond, of course, was a major site for that triangle trade, for the slave trade. And slaves would be brought up the James River, unloaded there at Manchester Docks, and then walked along a trail, which is now preserved by the city, and up over the bridge and into downtown, where they had all the slave jails and auction houses. Some of those structures still exist there. And the city has, in more recent years, attempted to acknowledge some of that. You know, for various reasons, including tourist reasons. You know, right. There are dollars to be made off of remembering even that segment of the history. But is also for dealing with the traumas of all this and the ongoing effects. So what the Buddhists did was they gathered there on the other side of the river where the slaves would have been unloaded. They walked along the path doing kind of walking meditation, not all meditation, just sitting there and, you know, looking inwards. So they were doing walking meditation, thinking about the experiences of the people, you know, in the past, what they would have experienced stepping on this exact same path. They came up over the bridge, they came down into downtown, and they sat there at a specific little park. It's the Slave Trade Reconciliation Memorial sort of triangle little park there that was created just in the last few years, right. There in Richmond. And there's a big statue there, kind of abstract, a big made out of some sort of black stone of two figures embracing, a sort of a symbolic sort of thing there. And they did the walking meditation. Then they came down, they sat in a circle, and they meditated in a normal Buddhist form of meditation there, but a very public sort of thing. This is right downtown, you know, like East Main and 15th Street. You've got the highway right next to you, the railroads, people are going by, you know, on the roads and everything. And you've got the slave auction houses just across the street, still preserved and this sort of thing. So you're right there in sort of the nexus of where this used to be. And so they meditate there, and in some ways they're perhaps trying to purify the negative energy there or try to get in touch with their own emotions about what happened there. They have various ways of explaining what's going on. They would do this and then get up, do some walking meditation. One other thing they did was they used that statue in the place of a Buddhist image that they would normally use.
Is that
at
right?
A temple. Yeah, so normally if you go to a Buddhist temple, there's going to be a big Buddhist statue there, and you're going to place flowers, incense, light candles in front of it, bow towards it, and you know, you have kind of your devotional ritual oriented towards that figure. Well, instead of using a holy Buddhist icon, instead they substituted this sort of statue of these two slaves, and you know, sort of, it's unclear. Are they clutching onto each other before they're going to be sold apart? Are they hugging each other in reconciliation after the
right.
trade has been abolished? It's totally left to you to wonder. But what it clearly is it's African slaves being depicted in this statue. That became their object of veneration for that day.
Right.
A very unusual thing. You will not find that practice in another part of the U.S., and you will certainly never find that practice in Asia. So the South is calling forth these new adaptations of venerable Buddhist practices, and even that kind of retreat, you know, vigil thing, that's a kind of broad American Buddhist thing at this point, but it calls forth these particular instantiations of that practice here in this region. So people are responding to that local history, those local needs.
Right.
They're just not doing that, you know, in San Francisco.
Right.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And to get to this point, to get to the point where you are so comfortable with this community and the rapport has been built, can you describe the employment of the ethnographic methodologies, maybe alongside some kinds of archival methodology, just briefly, and what was that like in this particular context?
Sure. So this was definitely participant observer methods here. So they have five groups. I went to the services or meetings of those groups as often as I possibly could, you know. And so they're meditating. I sat there and meditate. They're discussing a book. I read that book and I talked about it with them. They're bowing. They're praying. They're chanting. All that stuff. I'm doing all of that. And there were many specific instances of doing this or that practice brought forth knowledge, observation that was useful to me in my analysis of this site. So that was very good. It also lowers the barriers between you and your informants so that you're amongst them, you're of them in a certain way. Of course, you're never actually fully of them, but it helps to bridge that gap, to bring those two different parties closer to one another. The better to understand them, also the better to make them comfortable, so they're more forthcoming. They're willing to tolerate you for longer and this sort of thing. So that participant observation was very important. The other thing I would say is my approach to sort of Southern religious ethnography is, you know, to sit in the pews with the people and to listen to them and to discuss my ideas and my observations about what they're doing over the potluck table with them, you know, this sort of thing, and to keep going back to the site, keep looking to see, am I right about this? Ask them, what do they think? They may not necessarily agree. Obviously, they're going to have totally different perspectives than someone who's coming in there for, you know, scholarly reasons, has a certain lineage and training and this sort of thing. But being willing to share those ideas and hear their perspectives on it. You know, at the end of the day, of course, I control what actually gets written here. But I can listen to them and I can try to look for ways to include their voices in there, their ideas, even if I don't necessarily agree with them currently, you know, in the final analysis. And the other thing I would just say is just humility is a big thing, too. They know what they're doing much better than I do. They'll always know better, and they are giving of themselves by letting me be there. So just being humble about it and letting the field speak to you rather than going in, you know, guns blazing, I already know what's going on there. That's sort of my approach.
This book is pretty one of a kind. If we're thinking about the study of Buddhism in the South.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, it's a fact, I think.
Yeah.
Where might people go after reading this book in terms of the study of Buddhism, or more broadly, just the study of non-evangelical religions in the South, or non-Protestant religions in the South? Where does this book leave us, and where might it take us?
Okay, very good. So the... I sometimes feel that there's an anxiety in the subfield, you know, about the South is changing. Oh, no, it'll stop being the South. We will stop having a reason to exist, and we won't be able to write our books and our articles and, you know, keep our tenure and all this sort of thing, you know. So, and also, there's a cultural anxiety there, too. It's not just, you know, the scholarly level, but many people who write about the South are invested in the South. And not just as a research object. So there's a lot of angst that you can encounter over the fact that the South is changing. Of course, the South has always been changing.
It has
gone through many phases, and you know. And so if we were going through a new phase, all the better for us. New research opportunities. It doesn't mean the South is going away. Just because everybody can tweet all day long and this sort of stuff, the South is not going anywhere. But it does become more complicated, more complex, and so there's more that we can look at.
Right.
And then in terms of people looking at, you know, what is the takeaway, basically? So I'm possibly the only one studying Buddhism in the South, right? So for everyone who is not me, what should they take away from this?
And by the way, those who are listening, if you are one of those people, contact me. We can,
we've
got things to talk about.
If you're, one thing, I hope that people will find that Buddhism is an interesting religion to study, that it has an interesting experience in the South. We've only just barely touched on a little bit of it here. There's many more ideas and experiences in the book itself. So there's a lot going on there. So it just in and of itself is an interesting object of study that has not received previous study. So I think there's the one thing to look at. And in some ways, it ties into some previous minority experiences that we're already familiar with in the Southern historiography. And in some ways, there are unique aspects of it. So it's interesting as further evolutions of a pattern, and it's interesting in its uniqueness as well. But more importantly, a lot of what I talk about at places in the book is the interaction between the Buddhists and the non-Buddhists. Another way to say it is, you know, between the mainstream Christianity that we're used to talking about and the newer players in their midst, such as the Buddhists. So the average evangelical Protestant Southerner or Catholic Southerner may well not know a Buddhist versus, you know, the average person in San Francisco probably does, you know, but though they may not know it, that's not true on the other side. All Buddhists know lots and lots of those folks.
Right.
So lots of those folks are interacting with Buddhists. Also, they may not even know it. And one thing that I found was a lot of the Buddhists are on the down low about what their practice is. Their families do not realize that they are no longer Baptists or Methodists, you know.
Right.
They are hiding that from them. They go to church in order not to have, you know, grandma ask about what they're doing on, you know, Wednesday night, when what they're doing is they're going to the meditation group, this sort of thing. So there are more Buddhists secretly amongst people's midst than they realize. But those sort of interactions, those relationships are interesting to look at. And sometimes these people are, let's say, out of the closet about their Buddhism with their Christian, wherever they fall on the spectrum, relatives and everything. Well, those people now have to deal with a different family situation and a different Southern religious experience than what they had presented to them previously. So they are not necessarily going to become Buddhists, and there's not going to be a Buddhist takeover or anything, but the Buddhists are there, and they're in their own families now. So they have to react to that. Buddhists are no longer foreigners who are somewhere on the other side of the world. We need to send missionaries there to save them.
Right.
Now they are our neighbors. They are our own children in some cases, and we have to think about this. We've been able to think of them as, oh, we need to bring them the message, and if we don't, well, too bad for them. So they've got a, you know, kind of crispy fate in store for them.
Right.
Right. Well, what do you do when suddenly it's your kid who's the Buddhist? In you go to church and you talk to folks about this, and they are not dealing with it, and so they have still a certain mindset about what's going on. You now have to really work through these sort of issues. So there's an impact on the majority, and it's out of proportion to the small numbers of Buddhists. But as soon as you just have a few of them, right, suddenly issues must be dealt with that didn't have to be dealt with before. So minorities can have a small numerical presence, but a larger cultural and religious impact on the mainstream. I think that's something for people who work on the mainstream to pay attention to.
Well, Jeff Wilson, thanks for joining us here in my hotel room in Indianapolis. This is the Journal of Southern Religion podcast. I think this is going to be our third installment, and we have a lot more in store. But Jeff Wilson, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And I'm Mike Pasquet, LSU. Please go to the journal website, jsr.fsu.edu, where you can see the changes that we've been making to the journal. We hope you like it. Thanks again, and goodbye.